From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz joins me to discuss the escalating conflict between Israel and Palestine and the potential impact of host nation Brazil's loss this week in the World Cup.
Perhaps the inequality was forgotten about momentarily. Now that this loss has occurred, some of those old animosities come out, plus the humiliation that many are feeling on top of this. And yes, October is election time.
Then I'll talk with national security analyst Linda Robinson. She spent 2 years in Afghanistan joining U.S. Special Forces on combat missions, while still knowing when to stay out of the way.
And I think that kind of approach allows people to see what special ops do, because we're not a secretive society. And I think ultimately it benefits them for more people to understand what they do.
The future of American military strategy. But first, the news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Rebecca, things in Israel continue to heat up. As we all already know by now, there were three kidnapped and then killed teenagers in the West Bank a couple of weeks ago. Hamas, of course, was blamed. There was a retaliation murder of a Palestinian teenager who was burned alive. Tens of thousands of Israeli reservists have now been activated. Dozens of Palestinians have been killed. I mean, can this really continue down this path? Are we looking at a third intifada?
Really hard to say at this point, but I think this is the sort of situation where we just kind of knew 2 weeks ago that this was going to continue to escalate. We're watching from a distance and I think kind of holding our breath that something would change, but it looked like it was going to happen. As you mentioned, the troops are there at the border. Now, going in, actually crossing over is probably not a very smart move. It puts those soldiers in a great deal of danger. And I think the other thing to point out is we are seeing some condemnation from the rest of the world. We are seeing even the Western world, the United States, the European Union members and Great Britain are coming out and saying, OK, we agree with Israel protecting their own sovereignty. They, of course, have been fired upon for the last couple of weeks from Hamas. We agree with them protecting their sovereignty, but the killing of innocent civilians, which is happening and dozens of civilians are dying, many of them children and older people as well, this we cannot condone. And so there is a voice of dissent from the rest of the international community, and I think that's important, and hopefully that will be enough to maybe cease actions here.
Well, of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu has vowed to continue this until the rocket fire stops from Gaza. I mean, these accidental wars that they keep getting into, I mean, this isn't good for anyone. It doesn't benefit anyone, and especially the Palestinians, given the last intifada set them back, some said, 20 years in terms of their development and growth and progress toward becoming an independent, recognized state. I mean, this isn't helping anyone, the Israelis or the Palestinians.
No, and it just becomes a tit for tat. There's one action, there's a reaction, there's another reaction. And you're right that in the end, we don't often see much change and we just see a lot of destruction and death, and the ingrained hatred continues.
Well, off to another continent, Rebecca, and perhaps a lighter topic, although perhaps not to the Brazilians. The Brazilians lost their World Cup bid this week, were humiliated, in fact, in that game against Germany, lost 7-1. It was shocking, shocking to everyone. Of course, the Brazilians couldn't believe it and then rioted in the streets. They're going so far as to kind of question themselves even. You know, they're saying they're so ashamed and humiliated. And it really reflects kind of the importance of the game and that community and that society. And the question is why? I mean, why are they so tied up on this? Because there was so much anger and concern about the World Cup to begin with, that being in Brazil. There were protests about it even being there. Of course, once it's there, then they want to win. They've won 5 World Cups. This was an interesting thing. And then some are saying it's going to affect the presidential elections, perhaps. I mean, the impact of soccer in Brazil is just tremendous.
Well, I think it's really hard for us in the United States to quite understand what soccer means to other countries. We have football, of course, here in Norman. But I think that soccer in many countries, and certainly in Brazil, that has won 5 World Cups, this so much becomes a part of their identity. This so much becomes a unifying force. The entire country cheering in their backyard, their front yard, for their country. And, you know, the loss to be as devastating as it was, 7-1. I mean, at least they got that extra one goal, and perhaps that makes it slightly better. But I do think they were devastated. And you're right, we saw a lot of protests leading up to the World Cup, a lot of questions about the president choosing to go forward with this, choosing to spend the amount of money necessary to build these stadiums, whether they were going to be finished, all of that. And this just speaks to the growing inequalities in that country as the country moves forward economically, has become, I think, the 6th or 7th largest economy in the world, and we see a lot of progress there, but still a great deal of inequality. And so while you have that unifying factor, perhaps the inequality was forgotten about momentarily. Now that this loss has occurred, some of those old animosities come out, plus the humiliation that many are feeling on top of this. And yes, October is election time.
Some are suggesting, though, that this is a lot like the last time Brazil hosted the World Cup and they lost. They lost in the final to Uruguay at that point in time. And there were all of these same kind of emotions and concerns. But it's a different Brazil today, very different Brazil today. And so I'm hearing now Brazilians actually saying, look, it's a loss. It was humiliating. We're ashamed. We're sad. But it is soccer after all. So perhaps they have made some strides.
Well, let's certainly hope so. And I think there has been an effort by many in Brazil to really highlight the good sportsmanship that did occur. I think the rioting that occurred after the loss was not nearly as bad as some had anticipated. There were signs of good sportsmanship and just trying to be Brazil strong. And maybe this will be a good moral victory in some ways.
Maybe it's a good thing for them that they lost. Well. Next week. Well, of course, we will see who wins in the final, the Germany-Argentina final this weekend. We can reflect on that later. So thank you very much, Rebecca, for being with me as always.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment for Rebecca or me, let us know on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzette Grelot and at Cruise226. You can also leave a comment in the Worldviews section of our website, KGOU.org. Next, I'm joined by Linda Robinson from the RAND Corporation for a conversation about U.S. Special Forces in Latin America and the Middle East. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Today I'm joined by Linda Robinson. She's a senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation, who focuses on national security strategy and military special operations. Robinson has just written a book called 100 Victories, Special Ops and the Future of American Warfare, that details the 2 years she spent embedded in Afghanistan and some of the challenges these elite warriors face every day. Linda Robinson, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you, Suzette. I'm delighted to be here.
I have to start by asking, what drew you to that topic? Why focus on special forces and special operations?
Well, I do get that question a lot, and I actually started my career focused on insurgencies down in Latin America, first in Central America, but also in Peru, Colombia, Mexico, and elsewhere. And also the democratization issue was something I covered heavily there. But the insurgency or small wars issue led kind of naturally to the flip side, which is counterinsurgency. What do people do when they're trying to combat an insurgency? And since that is one of the main missions for the special forces, I gained some entree really first in Colombia, down in Latin America, where the special forces were ramping up a counterinsurgency support effort. So that is, the Colombians were in the lead, but U.S. special forces were helping them and training them. What had originally been a counter-narcotics effort morphed into a counterinsurgency effort because there were two very strong insurgencies. 40 years, the FARC was the largest of the two groups in Colombia. That had really grown in strength to control half of the country. So it was a good, real first lesson for me in what special forces could do to help a country. And right now, flash forward a decade or so later, Colombia is engaged in very serious peace talks with the remnants of the FARC. And there is quite a a strong expectation that they will be able to wrap up their war with a negotiated accord. So, of course, the special forces weren't solely responsible for that progress, but it gave me a window into the various things that they do. And I had to go through a lot of hoops to gain that access. So I spent a lot of time doing research and attending exercises and briefings. They had really not let anyone inside to see what they do. And one officer had said, you know, nothing has been written about us since Vietnam, and much of what was written in that era wasn't good. So let's take a chance on this reporter and see if she's willing to really do some in-depth research on us.
Well, I want to get back to that issue of your access and specifically what it is you did on the ground to spend, you know, what that was like, spending time in with the special forces. But I want to get to this issue of the actual special operations themselves. I mean, your most recent book talks about how special ops are the future of American warfare. And we've been hearing this for some time, that this really is the way in which we're going to be fighting our wars in the future. But you begin your story in this most recent book at a time when you say that special forces were kind of at a crossroads, that they were very unclear about their goals, that they were unsure of their procedures and the effectiveness of those procedures. So when was it that it became more clear that special forces were going to be the way that we were going to fight wars? And what's the reason for that?
Well, there are multiple uses of special operations forces. That's the important thing. We can peel that apart a bit. A lot of people, they may have watched some Hollywood movies or, you know, seen through video games, the Call of Duty, this kind of thing, and gotten a very narrow view of what special ops do. And that really is the commando raid. You know, the guys coming in the dead of night, jumping out of helicopters to grab up some people. And that is certainly part of what they do, and they call that direct action. But what I, when I say they are the wave of the future, what I am referring to is really working among populations and with indigenous groups. And that's what I covered extensively in this book and in Afghanistan, going to and from for about 2.5 years to watch as they were going into villages where the insurgency was strong, the Taliban in the case of Afghanistan, and seeing whether the villagers had the desire to form self-defense groups, whether their village elders were ready to stand up and try to pull the village, rally the village together and form a local government, in effect. So they went out into the most godforsaken places, frankly, very remote areas where there weren't any other troops. And they did have a fair amount of success. Today, there are 26,000 local defenders, people defending their villages out there. And that was something that they had done this in the Vietnam era, but they had gotten away from that in the years after 9/11. Their focus had really been on these direct action raids. So what I viewed what was happening in Afghanistan was they were kind of recovering their roots and going back to working with populations and also working with indigenous military forces. So, for example, in Afghanistan, they have mentored an Afghan special ops organization that includes commandos, special forces, a ranger type unit, a nascent helicopter wing. So it's all under this rubric of getting those countries able to defend and secure themselves. And that, to me, is a more long-term solution, while recognizing they still do the direct action raids, but that is more of a temporary piece of the puzzle than the whole enchilada.
My guest is Linda Robinson, a policy analyst at the RAND Corporation and the author of the book 100 Victories, Special Ops and the Future of American Warfare. She studied and worked alongside U.S. Special Forces in Colombia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Let's get back to my conversation with Linda Robinson. She's an international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation, who has spent years studying military special operations in Latin America and the Middle East. Just before the break, she described the broader role special forces play while working with indigenous populations in Afghanistan. So the day-to-day operations of special forces, this is really what you're focusing on. And would you say that your work is kind of looking at the evolution of this organization itself and how it's evolved, like, as you said, from Vietnam to then later Latin America and now the Middle East? I mean, how, you know, it's changed as an organization.
Yes, absolutely. That is really what I've delved into pretty deeply. And the organization since 9/11 has grown, over doubled in size. There are now 33,000 badged uniformed special operators, and they have all different specialties there. It's also important to mention civil affairs, psychological operations. They have their own helicopter pilots. They have their own fixed-wing airplane pilots. So they really form a community that draws from Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force. And they come together in a joint command, but their hallmark is really operating in small numbers. So unlike the large footprint counterinsurgency model that Iraq represented, this is really looking at putting small numbers, hundreds or low thousands, on the ground to help a country be able to defend itself. And they've done this in places. Colombia is one of those case studies that is considered a success. Philippines is another one. They've been doing some of this work in East Africa as well. So it is what I see as part of this model of the future, being able to use them in small numbers. And their growth has permitted them to be out and deployed. About 12,000 can be deployed around the world at any one time as a sustainable number. And some people may say, oh, my gosh, that's a lot. Well, if you consider it compared to 100,000 plus in Iraq, it's not. That's what they mean by small footprint approach.
So the small footprint approach, then, as I was about to ask you about this, so operating in the hundreds or low 1,000s, that this is what allows these types of forces to be able to be more effective and get to what you were talking about early, kind of building partner capacity to be able to protect themselves, defend themselves, that it's better than the larger show of force. Make that distinction for us, how it is that this small number is much more capable of getting us down that path as opposed to this larger show of force.
Right. Well, I'll just do the math quickly for the village stability operations in Afghanistan. There were 72 teams, and these are 12 to 16-man teams. The SEALs are in platoons that are 16, and the Army Green Berets are in 12, but small teams going out to a village or a district. 72 of those spread around, mostly in the conflict area, but they were in the low thousands, if you even consider their support command structure around them. The low thousands produced almost 30,000 Afghan local police. So that's a huge multiplier effect. And those 30,000 Afghan local police, assuming the Afghan government chooses to continue with them, they will be there providing village security. Already, I just made my last trip out there last month, the special forces have left most of those villages and they're carrying on. So the idea is you set them up, you train them, you get them connected to their local police chief, the provincial police chief, and then you pull back. And they're still overseeing some of the institution building aspects and that the training center is providing some oversight. But the idea really is, in some number of years, and you can fill in the blank, sometimes it takes a number of years, but you're eventually moving off of that. So it's not a permanent commitment of even those few thousand. And that's, I think, the model for post-2014 in Afghanistan, to continue on with some of these missions in very small numbers.
Well, As promised, I had to get back to your access. I mean, your being able to tell this story is really remarkable. You know, the fact that you spent 2.5 years with the special forces in Afghanistan and that you're able to give us this kind of detail. How do you go about getting that kind of access to this kind of activity, which, I mean, by nature, we think of special forces and special operations as something that's highly secretive, that's not, you know, it's not very, you know, transparent. I mean, how is it and why is it that they would want you to tell this story?
Yes. Well, and it did go back initially to that one major that said to his boss, nobody's ever written anything about us and certainly nothing good. Why don't we see what it will take to get someone to really understand what we do? So it was that step-by-step process. I did not, as nothing in my career did I know what the next step was going to be. But I really did devote. I had a year at Harvard on a fellowship, and I spent a lot of time reading a lot of the literature and getting myself really informed about military doctrine in general, because I wasn't a military expert. I've never served in the military. But this gave me a really solid grounding in the professional aspects of what they do and how they're deployed. And it's fairly, you know, complicated stuff. So then they started bringing me down to exercises because they also wanted to see, could I handle myself in situations? Because going out, especially with a 12-man unit in a very hostile area, I could jeopardize those people as well as myself, as well as their mission. So there was a certain amount of vetting that was going on. And it was something that I had to really prove myself with each unit. When I arrived, I did this in Iraq, in the beginning of the Iraq War, and I was dumped off in Basra with these special forces teams, and they really didn't want to have to deal with me. They were in the middle of some heavy operation. So I got on the back of the Humvee and I just stayed there, and I knew they were busy. So I waited until I had time to interview them. And I think that kind of approach really does pay off. You do your homework, you stay out of the way, and then you eventually get your access and your interviews. And gradually that built on itself, so they recognized that I had a degree of expertise. They became more willing to share with me more and more of what they were doing and allow me to go to more places and have more access. So I think it has provided some of the most in-depth coverage that in turn allows people to see what special ops do, because we're not a secretive society. And I think ultimately it benefits them for more people to understand what they do. Now, that said, there are certain operations they don't want anybody on. And for example, they were not going to take an embedded journalist out to the bin Laden raid. But I do think they are remarkably open now compared to when I began this 12 years ago. They are much more willing to share, including things that haven't gone right. And I think that there's kind of a recognition that if you can share your mistakes as well, you know, that makes you a little more credible if you're willing to be honest about things that haven't gone right. And there certainly have been things that have gone very wrong. And war is a very, you know, unpredictable and violent business. So I'm not one to stand here and say it's all been good. I've seen plenty of things that didn't work, including in this book. There are lots of episodes of things that didn't work, places where they didn't manage to understand the population, places where they were at odds with the conventional forces or with coalition partners or the Afghan government. So there's nothing easy about the stuff that they do.
Definitely nothing easy, and certainly nothing easy about reporting on it either, I'm sure. Well, Linda, thank you so much for being with us today to tell us your fascinating story and provide us some insight into something that we don't normally get to see. Thank you.
Thanks, Suzette.
You've been listening to my conversation with Linda Robinson, who studies military and national security issues for the RAND Corporation's Washington office. We have more information and a link to her book, 100 Victories, Special Ops and the Future of American Warfare, online at kgou.org. The University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with KGOU. Nick Aguilera prepared the research for this interview. Brian Hardzinski edits the show. And we'd like to welcome our new research and booking producer, Symphony Swift. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.